Hi, and welcome to Redig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
We are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in and around New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring the culture to horticulture. And today we have two really great guests, author Andrew Keyes and photographer Carrie Michaels, discussing garden writing and photography and their new book called Growing the Northeast Garden, published by Timber Press. But before we do that, we need to do the horticultural honor roll. Alice, that's a great... That was Alice, by the way. That's better than the recorded sound.
No.
No, I think it's good. So today is all about place, right? Specifically the Northeast of the United States, which has been my home.
Blasted with snow.
Yes. We're very familiar with it. I've lived here a really long time, and so has Alice. And it kind of got us thinking about the phrase genius loci, which translated from the Latin means, quote unquote, spirit of place, which for the Romans referred to the guardian spirits or the protective spirits of a place. In fact, many Roman altars that were found throughout the Western Roman Empire were dedicated to a particular genius loci. Now, today we use that term in a much less literal and in a rather different way. It's meant to denote a place's distinctive qualities or atmosphere. And landscape designers and architects often refer to this idea indirectly when they use phrases such as designing in context or making a landscape with a sense of place. And it got me wondering where we got this idea from a design and architectural point of view. Well, we have a specific person to thank for that, the great 18th century English poet Alexander Pope. Pope made the term genus loci an important principle in garden and landscape design with the following lines from Epistle 4 to Richard Boyle, Earl of Burlington. Alice is going to read an excerpt from his Essay on Man, which is a long philosophical poem written in four parts and never quite finished.
That sounds like my life. Okay. To build, to plant, whatever you intend, to rear the column or the arch to bend, to swell the terrace or to sink the grot. In all, let nature never be forgot, but treat the goddess like a modest fair, nor overdress, nor leave her wholly bare. Let not each beauty everywhere be spied, where half the skill is decently to hide. He gains all points, who pleasingly confounds, surprises, varies, and conceals the bounds. Consult the genius of the place in all that tells the waters to rise or fall, or helps the ambitious hill the heavens to scale, or scoops in circling theaters the veil, calls in the country, catches opening glades, joins willing woods and varies shades from shades, now breaks or now directs the tending lines, paints as you plant and as you work, designs.
Isn't that great? I especially love that last line, you know? So this verse kind of laid the foundation for one of the most widely agreed principles of landscape architecture. That is the principle that landscape design should always be adapted to the context in which they're located. And I can't think of a better introduction for our two multi-talented guests today. The author and photographer of Growing the Northeast Garden by Timber Press. Andrew Keyes is the writer and a lifelong gardener and author of Why Grow This When You Can Grow That, which I also have, and it's a great book.
Yeah, he was on our show about a year and a half ago.
And Andrew's writing has appeared in This Old House magazine and Fine Gardening, and he's produced podcasts for Fine Gardening and Horticulture magazine. And Carrie Michaels is a photographer, writer, and multimedia producer. Her garden photographs have been seen in many books, magazines, and websites. She is a contributing photographer and writer for Coastal Home Magazine and is the writer and photographer for the popular website containergardening.about.com. Hi, guys. Welcome to We Dig Plants.
Hi. Thank you.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Andrew, how much snow do you guys have up in Boston?
Well, I'm actually on my cell phone right now talking to you, and I'm sitting in my car because I had to run out here from my office. and I'm looking at a probably 7-foot wall of snow at the end of this parking lot.
Yeah.
pushed up.
So insane.
We really have nothing to complain about in New York, do we? By comparison.
So insane.
So we, Alice and I get very excited when we get an actual printed book to review. And one of the things that interests us is the process of how a book gets put together. And as you're both writers, but Carrie, you're also a photographer. Can you tell us about how the collaboration worked? Carrie, why don't we start with you?
Well, it was, for me, it was just a total joy because it all started in the beginning when Andrew, I think he gave me a list of like 400 plants, and and it was like this giant year-long treasure hunt to not only find the plants, many of which I did not know, but also to find them at their peak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was this, it was just so exciting because I learned so much about plants and I had so much fun. Of course, sometimes it was a little stressful trying to find the exact plant, you know, at its blooming, beautiful peak. But it was just, you know, it was a delightful and exciting collaboration for me.
So are you guys, how do you know each other? Are you friends or do you know each other through the gardening world?
I believe that we met on Twitter.
Ah.
We did, yeah.
Good.
Probably in, I would say, like 2008.
Okay.
Yeah, so we both caught Twitter on the upswing, and we are definitely friends and more in-person friends now. But, yeah, we met on Twitter. It's true.
Both saying quippy plant things.
So, Andrew, tell us about the process for you. So Carrie had to go and hunt down hundreds of plants to photograph. What was the process for you in making this book?
Yeah, I always start with the plant. So I know that you noticed and will probably ask me about other parts of the book, but the first place that I had to think about were just the entries of the plants and kind of how to divide those plants up.
Yes.
Most books be like this, divide plants up by season. And so I thought, okay, well, that's a good idea, but that didn't quite kind of hit everything that I wanted. And then it occurred to me that some of these plants are just good sort of mainstays that have a long season of interest. And I really wanted this book to focus on plants with a long season of interest. So if you look in the plant entries that are the meat of this book, there's the first part of that, before all the seasonal plants, is a chapter called Framework. And these are the plants that are good over a really long season, really a lot of them year-round. So I kind of broke out our framework plants and then spring, summer, fall, and winter, and then really made, like Gary said, a really long list and then kind of had to whittle it down. And then had to break it out for Carrie and think, like, okay, what's going to look good now and where is it going to be, and try to give her a sense of where you'll find these plants. And then, you know, okay, these might not be convenient to you, so I might be able to go shoot those really quickly. And we really just sort of had to divide and conquer. It was a lot more maddening for me because I had to do that and write at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. So there's no...
I was really thrilled that Carrie was so happy about it.
Well, I loved how you had divided that up, actually, because sometimes in some books, the plants are just put alphabetically, which I think is kind of crazy. I mean, unless it's like,
it just
compendium.
Makes it so academic and boring.
Yeah,
you know?
This way, it's kind of it's very, very practical. And I got a few plants. I mean, there's a lot of, we are on the same wavelength in terms of plants we like for the Northeast. Alice and I use so many of them that... You know, in our own gardens and in the gardens that we make for our clients.
Yeah, it's like an old. Your book is like an old friend. To
yeah,
us.
It's really great.
That's great.
I want to touch on the photography a little bit again. Carrie, your photography was amazing. I love the matte finish, you know, of the book, and I think that it had a very nice format, the square format. Some of my favorite shots were the ones from the Putney Garden in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel like the photographer, you know, always gets kind of shortchanged, like second billing. And, you know, so I want to ask you more about the process of getting those amazing shots. And can you share some of the tips on getting sort of like the essence of a place as we're talking about place? Like, how do you set the mood, you know, for getting those shots?
Well, you know, it's such, especially if you're traveling to a garden, which all of these, there was a couple of gardens, you know, nearby, but most of the gardens I traveled to, so you're so weather dependent, and it was so funny because so often it was raining, and I had to sort of duck around the rain, but it worked out really well because I love shooting when it's cloudy and sort of moody and rainy, and
yeah,
and also in the morning or in the evening, but the gardens that we did were all just so heavenly, and you know, just being in them felt like an enormous privilege. And I kind of go into like a zone when I'm in a beautiful garden, and I kind of just dance around it. And one of the challenging things in most gardens is to really give a sense of the overall space.
Yeah.
So I often would try and get up high, like shoot from a second story window, mm-hmm. or get to the highest point, or even on ladders, so you can get that kind of overall sense of the garden. You know, the close-ups are really fun, but the real challenge for me is getting the sense of space, which I think... you know, because we shot huge, like the Putney Garden of Gordon and Mary Hayward was enormous. I mean, it was just vast and so beautiful. And then the little Brooklyn Garden, James Golden's garden, is just this small gem. Mm-hmm. So it was really a wonderful challenge to try and make both of them feel, you know, important as they are.
Right, and equal in weight.
Yes.
Which is, yeah. How did you select the gardens that are in the book?
Andrew found, I think, four, and then I found two of them, mm-hmm. that I knew about and loved. Mm-hmm. So he did a great job choosing gardens that were very diverse and, you know, had a lot of different elements to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the book, you devote a chapter to climate, and you remind us how important it is, of course, for gardeners to understand their local climate. And obviously, we started out the show talking about the winter, yeah. in this Northeast,
mm-hmm.
has been the forefront of people's minds. Of course, I mean, you know,
record-breaking cold.
Yeah,
and...
in our area of the United States. So... how do you think this winter will affect the seasons ahead, and how do you think the gardens will be affected?
Well, you know, the good thing about a winter like this is that, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but I've always noticed and I've always heard that when we have a winter with lots of snow, spring is beautiful. I mean, things, yeah. just flourish, and it's not just because we're so excited for it. I remember Margaret Roche is a really wonderful gardener and writer in the Hudson Valley, actually. And I remember her saying after the winter where we got so much snow, her apple trees bloomed like they never bloomed before.
Yeah.
And I think that really holds true. So, I mean, when all of this snow melts, it's really good in terms of groundwater and in terms of the soil. You know, the soil can be saturated if we had a really warm snap, and it, you know, there could be flooding. But, you know, the hope is that this melts slowly. And it, I mean, we're not really lacking in water, whereas they are in lots of other parts of the country.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, my hope is that this will sort of gradually melt, and then we'll have a really nice spring and summer, and it will be beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah, I've definitely noticed that too. And you know, it's always tricky because spring itself is so unpredictable. You never really know,
mm-hmm.
what the, yeah. spring is going to bring. But I, yeah. think you're right about water and that,
and the snow cover.
We have
the snow cover has
and it's
been...
insulation, you know, and then it's,
yeah.
it's really nice.
Although in New York, in Brooklyn, it's looking more like a filthy meringue than
yeah.
a fluffy,
yeah.
white kepper.
It's, yeah,
it's
like
kind of.
It,
did you
I
guys?
Years ago, we had to, I remember a sort of alert going out in the springtime because we had had a dry winter and then a dry spring. and yeah. people were having to water yeah. early in the spring.
Yeah.
That's just unheard of.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll have to do this this year.
No.
Yeah. Yesterday we got a tiny micro thaw. It probably happened up where you are too as well. We got yeah, up to
it was 45, I think.
Yeah.
46.
So I tried to collect the water from some of the roofs of my house. And I flipped the gutters from going out into the street to into the garden. I'm like, yeah. okay, we're going to irrigate now because yeah. the snow was just kind of sitting there and not melting. And the roof hit the, you know, face south. So all this water
yeah.
went into the garden, into places where, you know, I'm like, this is great because I know that that will help them push out in the spring a little bit faster,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
So
yep.
I'm hoping that we have a wonderful spring. We definitely... We those deserve
first,
it.
Those first spring days, I always feel like it's like lizards.
I think we're due.
Yeah.
We're entitled.
I always feel like it's like lizards coming out from under rocks. You know?
Yeah.
Those first spring days.
I think everybody...
Everybody in the world was out yesterday, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah. it felt like a bomb. We've had such cold, and so have you all,
yeah.
that a 45-degree day felt like spring already, you know?
So. But I have yeah. to say, Carrie... Carrie, I spend the majority of the winter looking at Coastal Living magazine.
Yes.
Well, I'm not Coastal Living. The magazine I work for is actually Coastal Home, which
Coastal
is
Home.
A
okay.
New England-based magazine.
Okay.
But it's also very lovely.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I do know your magazine. I'm sorry that I misspoke. But, yeah, I spend a lot of time looking at water real estate.
Yes, yes. And I'm up in Maine, so we're, you know, as soon as it hits maybe 28 degrees, all the kids put on shorts.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah. That's a heat wave, right?
Exactly.
Right, because you guys are in snow really till early May, right? I mean, depending on where you live.
We usually get a snowstorm in April, and then yeah. kind of, you know, that last piles of snow are kind of petering out by May.
Yeah. Yeah, but man, what a beautiful summer you all offer
yeah,
in Maine.
Yeah, big payoff.
Like the best place in the country, I think.
Carrie,
I
what,
agree.
Carrie, what part of Maine are you in?
I'm in southern Maine.
Okay.
Uh-huh. My brother went to the landing boat school or the wooden boat school in Kennebunkport.
Oh, yeah,
so we spent a
sure.
lot of time up there when I was growing up.
So beautiful.
Yeah. Well, we have to take a break. We stay on the line. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
Break's song is called Creek Time by Odetta Hartman. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio, and we are talking with two special guests, Andrew Keyes and Carrie Michaels, respectively, author and photographer of the new book, Growing the Northeast Garden, just published by Timber Press. And I have to say, that was a beautiful winter song like going into spring, water melting
kind
of song.
Yes, very evocative. I'm going to have to get that track. Yeah. Maybe Jack can help me out with that.
Odetta, beautiful. So the Northeast is a pretty big area, and it's pretty diverse. So in your book, you have very generously broken it down into different sorts of geographical areas, a mountain section, coastal, woodland, and you've included a metropolitan section, which of course Carmen and I are so excited about. But let's talk about that and the heat effect that cities have and how this affects some of the gardening choices in your book.
Yeah. I think the heat island effect that cities have, you know, in a lot of ways it makes it so in cities you can grow things. I mean, you're almost a zone warmer sometimes.
Right.
So in that sense, you can grow plants that might be more tender that even people maybe even an hour outside the city might not be able to grow.
Right.
That's really interesting. I mean, the whole heat island thing is not great environmentally.
Right.
But, you know, in terms of we're just talking about what we can grow, that's something to consider. It also, sort of on the other end, you have to consider the fact that your plant in a city garden will be exposed to a lot more heat than maybe a garden in the suburb.
Right.
So that's an interesting challenge, too. You need to pick plants with better heat tolerance. Or make it so the situation that your plants are in is such that they can take the heat more.
So what are some of your favorite city plants? Because you're an urban gardener too, right?
Sort of. I do live in the suburbs outside of Boston, but I think the interesting thing, I think I mentioned this in the metropolitan section of the book, the interesting thing between the cities and suburbs is that you never quite know what you're going to get soil-wise. soil in city gardens, like true urban garden plots, is not known for being great.
Right.
But the interesting thing is that so much of the suburbs these days, especially in more newly developed areas, developers will completely remove the topsoil. So suburban gardeners are working with really terrible soil, too.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But, yeah, in terms of plants, I mean, a lot of the plants that I've tried to choose here are tough plants. I am not a fan of coddling plants. So across the board here, the plants in this book are automatically going to have a leg up for people in the city. I think that the best thing to do is to go to the section of the book that shows James Golden's garden in Brooklyn and look at what he's growing there and see if you can pick out plants that are in that. I really like grasses that can take some shade for cities because grasses are always tough.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about grasses, though, is that a lot of them really want sun. And city gardens deal with funny light situations that I actually deal with in my garden in the suburbs, too, where you'll get this sort of twilight time that is kind of like you don't get any morning sun, and then all of a sudden it's blasted in the afternoon. And then the sun goes away at like 4.
Yes.
Because you're sort of sandwiched in between buildings. So you need plants that can take that sudden onslaught of really hot sun, but then can take a little shade too. So I think there are a few grasses, like sedges, things like that like some shade. For some reason, the plant off the top of my head that I'm obsessed with right now is called palm sedge. And James Golden actually grows that in his garden in Brooklyn. It's a really cool plant, but you know, on the spot, I'm just rattling off. I've got a million plants running through my head here.
tonight,
basically anything that can take dry shade,
is
probably a good bet because it will probably be okay with some sun too. So that's usually a good plant sort of situation. An urban garden.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about the Golden Garden in Brooklyn. I was really excited to see that in the book, and it had a lovely water feature as well. How did you guys find that garden? And tell us about it, the owner and how he created it.
Yeah, James Golden is actually a blogger, and he has a blog. I believe it's still called this. That it's called The View from Federal Twist or something like that. He has a really large garden outside the city that's called Federal Twist, and mm-hmm. I think that's really what he's been known for. But I think in the a couple of years ago, he started to feature this smaller garden that he had begun to build in Fort Greene in Brooklyn. And when I was, it was really important to me in this book to feature a garden that was in New York City. I mean, it's the most populous city in the country. This is a book about gardening in the Northeast. Every gardening book ever shows gardens that are sort of on estates and big and beautiful, and those are great, those are wonderful, but I really wanted to portray a garden that is beautiful but is also very much an urban garden. So I think more people probably know James for his garden outside the city, but I sent him a message that was like, hey, can we feature your garden that's in the city, because I think that's really exciting. This garden is only a few years old, actually. It's still fairly young. But you can see he's done so much with it just in that short period of time. He has really interesting... He's clearly a plant geek, which I love. Likes really cool plants. But he's a really fantastic designer, too. Has this great natural design sensibility. Mm-hmm. And he took this small backyard in Brooklyn and just completely transformed it. So, yeah, I think over time, there are actually four trees on that coordinate with the corners of the reflecting pool in this garden, and those will grow up, and then the garden will change some. So it's just it's really interesting space. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, this is really cool. This is something special.
Yeah, it was, you know, we work in that scale all the time, and we were impressed with how many plants and yeah. what a diversity of plants were in there. The textures, the water feature, too. It was really, really nice.
And what's really nice also about it is that it's got some really strong geometric lines.
Yeah.
But it's so soft and lush because of the plant material and the plant choices. So it's very striking, absolutely.
And the focus was not on flowering and color.
No, you know? it was texture and foliage.
It was great. And that's something that's a... That's a mantra that we try to impress upon our clients, too, that it isn't always, you know, color isn't and flowers isn't always the goal, you know, to create a mood and to create an effect. Everybody's just so obsessed with color, 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 flower, 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 and not accepting that it is shady and that it, you know, not accepting the site, the site conditions, you know, like fighting the site conditions. And you actually say that in the book. You say, don't fight the site.
Well, you know? All right. Let's bring Carrie back into this discussion, because one of the first gardens that I actually really ever fell in love with in my life was in Agunquit, Maine. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, right smack on the water. There's this, it's called the Marginal Trail, and it's this walking path that's probably like, I don't know, 4 or 5, maybe 4 miles long. And it's right literally on the cliffs. In Maine, and there was this big, sprawling, beautiful hotel that had this amazing perennial garden. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like, this is gorgeous. And then the next summer we went to Nantucket, and I was, you know, just, I think I was about 12, 13, and really paying attention to the gray color of, like, New England skies, you know, and then these brilliant, vibrant purples and greens and yellows from like a very traditional style border, and the roses. You know, you cannot ignore roses in New England mm-hmm. in the seaside gardening. So that's a very different aspect of New England too, is that we really have these amazing microclimates of conditions. Right, Carrie?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, it is just always staggering to me how, you know, there's a look, but how diverse the gardens are throughout New England. You know, you can have sort of this cottagey garden, lovely look, but then that same look can be transformed with different plants and made more modern and...
Yeah.
you know, one of the places that's my one of my favorites in the world is the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, which I think may be the only coastal public garden in New England, or, you know, it's, and it is just amazing, and it's just, it is such a magical place to go, and, you know, their plants are just exciting and interesting, and the hardscaping is all fantastic. But back to microclimates, that's, you know, they have just incredible diversity of climates just in that garden. But in my gardens, you know, one side of my house is a completely different zone than the other side of the house.
Right.
And we deal with, you know, incredible winds
here. Yeah.
Yes. It's similar to New York City rooftops. One of the things that we actually treat rooftop gardens kind of like coastal gardens in a way, because it's sun. Mm-hmm. I mean, there isn't the salt factor, but there's pollution. So we have to consider...
But the wind is the altitude.
And the sun, it's very different up there.
Yeah, than it is on the street.
Especially for things like deciduous trees, mm-hmm. you know, things... So we, Andrew, we use grasses a lot and some really tough meadow perennials to good effect. And we also have to deal with the containerization of plants. That, and I know, Carrie, you know a lot about that because that's kind of your love and specialty.
Yeah.
Growing things in containers is really different mm-hmm. than in the ground. There's so many other issues. And that's what you write about as well, Carrie, don't you? Container gardening.
Yeah. And again, you know, it one of the exciting things about containerizing your plants is you can grow cactus in Maine, and, you know, you're just given such a much wider latitude of what you can grow.
Right.
And you can grow blueberries, I would think, on a rooftop in New York City if you, you know.
We have.
Container. We do. So that's one of the things that I find really exciting about container gardening.
Yeah, yeah.
And pushing the zones a little bit. You know, I have plants that I drag in and out.
Yeah.
Because I want to have certain effects that you can't get, you know, without, you know, pushing the zone a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, Andrew, I wanted to ask you about this. So you have a lot of tough plants, and you have some great plants in the book that I was excited to see. But I was surprised to see one of your choices was the bald cypress, which, you know, I kind of think of as like a quintessentially southern plant. Never thought of putting one in a northeast garden. Tell us, I know you're from the south originally, but why did you include that in this book, and how can people use it?
Yeah, bald cypress is interesting because that's an iconic tree of the south.
Yeah.
But that tree is just incredibly versatile and incredibly adaptable. I have seen that tree growing in Traffic Island, Dallas, Texas, which are not damp.
No.
This is a marshland tree, you
right.
know.
Water loving.
They grow it in the medians in Dallas. And then one of the gardens, this didn't make the cut. But the garden in Needham, Massachusetts, that's in the book.
Yeah.
Growing bald cypress in her backyard behind the large area that you see in the book. There's this sort of very marshy, her backyard is very marshy. And she has bald cypress growing, and hers actually have the cypress knees like they get in the south.
Because it's wet.
And I'm
because,
like, wow, I've never seen this happen in the Northeast. Never ever. And she's like, yeah, and they did it pretty quickly, too. I planted them here, and within a year or two, they were making the cypress seed. So, I mean, it's just one of the bald cypress is just one of those plants that, even though it comes from a very specific type of place, it's actually adaptable to all kinds of climates and really garden worthy too. So, yeah, it isn't. I love plants like that.
That is surprising.
They can grow just as well in this part of the country and that part of the country that are completely different.
I guess we're going to have to find an urban garden, Alice, that has enough room.
Yeah, that's the space.
Maybe in the suburbs. Maybe when we do a project in the suburbs, we can maybe integrate it.
Well, we did at the one out by in the Five Towns. We planted that cypress.
Not a bald cypress.
It was the false cypress, but it has the knees. it can grow the knees. And we planted it right on that pond. I don't
know
if
yes.
you remember.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we'll have to find a home
Many
for bald cypress. That's exciting.
So let's talk a little bit about Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, because you can't talk about New England gardens without talking
Northeast.
About Swarthmore.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, Northeast.
So this is the garden of Andrew Bunting, and it really has everything that Carmen and I love about personal gardens. It has some amazing stonework, great formal elements, some beautiful craftsmanship in the details, and tropicals. And I love that you do include tropicals as like focal points. Can you talk a little bit about how people can use them to good effect?
I think that's a good question for Carrie, actually, because, you know, we tend to put tropicals in containers a lot.
Yeah.
The Andrew Bunting Garden, oh, my God, it was just so amazing. And one of the things that I'm not sure is in the book, but he has a giant mirror behind his pond that lightens up this very dark area, and it's just, it was so imaginative, and those pops of red, which I think, you know, he amplified with the tropicals. You know, he's got a red door and red
yes.
Adirondack chairs, and then some of the tropicals have the red in it. And I think, you know, it is just such a wonderful way to give a feeling of kind of exoticism and luxury to a garden. And then the Needham garden, she has a enormous, like, two-story banana plant that mm-hmm. she hauls in and out every year.
Wow. I thought I was bad.
Yeah, that's planted in the ground. The thing is just enormous and gorgeous.
Wow.
So I think it is just a wonderful way to sort of think outside the box for Northeast gardens.
Right.
Which kind of tropicals do you like, Carrie, to use?
Well, I love the cannas
mm-hmm.
and, you know, kind of ponytail palms, kind of those big froofy things.
Yeah.
yeah.
You know, because you the textures you just don't find in sort of typical New England plants.
Right.
And the bananas. I love the bananas.
Yeah.
I love, I always get one. I try to overwinter it. Sometimes it doesn't make it. Papyrus. I know it sounds kind of goofy.
Really? That's so cool.
But it's one of these aquatic papyrus. There's the dwarf ones, and then there's the standard one. It is so easy to include in the garden to get really fast height. And mm-hmm. to get that beautiful texture of almost like a grass. And all you need is a watertight container,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I have a big Asian bowl. I plop, you know, the papyrus in. And invariably, whenever I have guests over, anybody visits the garden, that is the first thing that they say that they want. Where can I get one of those?
Yeah.
You know, and most people don't know what it is. And I'll say, oh, it's a papyrus. And they're like, really? You can grow them here? And I said, this is, if you have the brownest thumb in the universe, you can grow a papyrus, you know? And it adds that amazing
exotic
textural. And another one for me that just I always have to have is a passion vine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they take a long time to get going,
mm-hmm.
but when they finally bloom, they are just, and I don't feel like it makes a temperate garden too jungly. I like just having a little bit of it. I mean, I wouldn't put lots of them. It's sort of like one and, you know, how would you guys respond to that? Where some people say, oh, you know, putting tropicals in makes it too jungly.
But it, you know, I think it depends on how many tropicals you mm-hmm. use. And it, you know, I think jungly, you know, at the Needham garden, she's got sort of a jungly section
mm-hmm.
Right on, starting on the driveway and going into the garden. And it's just divine because it sets an atmosphere. So I think, you know, jungle can be great. I don't know what you think, Andy, but it's just,
in moderation.
I mean, places.
You know, I think that I think different people like different things.
Yeah.
And bottom line is that we're talking about ornamental plants here. And when we're talking about ornamental plants, these are plants that should only bring you joy. Yeah. So if jungly plants are what bring you joy, then I think you should do it.
All right.
As long as you're not doing it at the expense of anyone else or the environment, things like that.
All right.
You should do jumping.
Well,
let's
go back just for a second as we end our show. Unfortunately, we're getting close to that time. And let's talk about some of the natives that you've included in the book and some that are underutilized. Trilliums, Veronicas, Saldego, Aruncus, Persicaria. These have amazing qualities and are perfectly adapted to their habitat. So why do you think people don't use them as much as they should, Andrew?
You know, I think that it's one of those things where there are sort of traditional favorite garden plants that have kind of been the ethos of these plants has been sort of passed down through generations. And it's like, ooh, I want to grow that because my grandmother grew that.
Right.
And these plants are not typically native plants, and that is sort of a shame. I actually do tend to love native plants because I grew up playing in the woods, and so I'm like, oh, I want to grow that plant
right
in the woods by my house.
Yeah,
and I do.
Right.
But not everyone had that experience.
Right.
So I think it's kind of unfortunate, and a lot of people don't necessarily when they go to the nursery, they're not necessarily separating plants that are native from plants that are non-native.
Yeah.
So they're just looking for what they like.
Yeah.
So I think that it's great you say that there are so many great native plants in the trade. That alone, I think, will hopefully boost the number of native plants that are in gardens now.
I agree.
There are plants like goldenrod, Solidago, that there are always people who think, oh, I'm allergic to that, and
things like that.
So there are some of the native plants do kind of fight that thing too.
Right.
But no, people are not allergic to goldenrod. I'm not afraid of arguing with people.
I know. That's not the plant that's causing the allergy.
No.
It's only been a couple of generations that we've really started to come back to our native plants. You know, I do agree with you that the more that merchants and nurserymen can tag them and identify them for people and say, look, this plant is going to be maybe a little bit easier to care for and be lower maintenance because it's native, because it's perfectly adapted, you know, to our region. So I think it's going to start to turn. You know, I think you're right.
Yeah.
You know, traditions are a big part. And you mentioned one word that like I had a riff on our Facebook post, which is terroir. You know what I mean? Like there's terroir for grapes and for wine, you know, viticulture. I think there's a kind of terroir for ornamental horticulture. And, you know, part of that is traditions. Right. And we're making new ones now.
Right.
You know, which I'm excited about.
Well, and I think the other aspect is, you know, the majority of beginning homeowners and gardeners, where do they go to shop? You know, like, unfortunately, they're going to Home Depot and Lowe's, and you're talking about base foundation planting plants anyway. So
at least here in New York, they don't have the biggest selection, and they don't. And I think when that starts to change,
right,
you know, that will help a lot as well.
Yeah, let's hope.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
Exactly.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you stay warm for the rest of the afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a delight.
Thanks.
Carrie, Carrie, really quick, and then Andrew, tell us where our listeners can find you. Where do you blog? Where can they find more of your writing and photography?
I am flyingpointphotography.com.
Okay, great. And Andrew?
I am just at andrewkeys.com.
Good.
Great. Well, thank you for the book. It's really inspirational.
Yes, congratulations. I hope you're going to go. I hope that there'll be some speaking engagements and y'all are going to be going around sharing all this wealth of knowledge that's included in this book.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Okay.
All right.
So we have to do a little shout out to our fans. Last week's winner was Timothy Collins.
I know. He was so excited and appreciative.
Yes.
He was amazing.
He's from Texas. If you want to win like Timothy, you got to go to our Facebook fan page, Groundworks, Inc.
He won some great tools.
Yes. And follow us. Or you can follow us on Instagram, which is at Groundworks Gardens NYC, to be entered in our weekly drawing, which is supplied this month, all the prizes by the Garden Tour. toolcompany.com, which is one of our favorite sources for quality garden tools. When you get tools from them, you can have them for a lifetime. They're really amazing. Thank you for listening to the show. The show has been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Marcus Krieg and engineered by Jack Inslee. And we'll see you in the garden.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.